When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, drivers and passengers. Welcome back to Car Stuff. I'm Ben Bullen.
And I'm Scott Benjamin.
And Scott, before we get started, this is going to be a little bit of a different podcast for us today. Before we get started, I wanted to just ask you about your recent adventures. Some of our listeners may not know that you have wandered internationally.
Yeah, that's right. I hinted before that it was taking a long vacation, I think, and I've been overseas, Ben. I've been on the other side, I guess, if you want to say it that way, a little more dramatically, right?
On the other side of the pole.
That's right. On the other side of the Atlantic for a significant amount of time. I was over there for a full 2 weeks.
Yep.
And we did quite a trip. I'll just tell you briefly about it, and
sure.
It leads to kind of an interesting driving experience. We went to Barcelona for 3 days. Did a Mediterranean cruise, which took us to Italy, France, back to Spain, and then we ended up in Ireland. It's just part of the trip flying back over. And in Ireland, we stayed for 3 days, and what's unique about this and where this kind of comes into the car stuff thing, we rented a car in Ireland.
Huh.
And renting a car in another country that drives on the left is a unique experience for someone like me.
What kind of car did you rent?
I rented here's the thing. It was a full-size vehicle, is what they call a full-size vehicle, which is a Mazda 6, a brand new Mazda 6.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the driver sits on the right-hand side, which was unique for me. I mean, I've done that one other time, but it was an automatic car. This was a manual and a diesel, which
uh-huh.
was really unique, strange. Not so much that it's strange to drive a diesel. It's just that driving a manual transmission vehicle from the right-hand side of the vehicle on the left-hand side of the road, that was difficult to get used to. But I tell you, I was really concerned about it. Once I did it for even an hour,
yeah,
I was relatively comfortable with it.
It's strange, isn't it, how quickly we can acclimate ourselves to changes like that.
Have you ever had a driving experience like that, something completely out of the ordinary?
You know what? I've never been driving in those situations. I've never rented a car in Europe or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a mooch, man. Just public transit and shotgun seat rides for me.
A mere passenger. The only real trouble I had, and I told you the shifting was something that came relatively quickly because, the pattern worked towards my leg, I guess, towards my left leg.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of working away from your right leg as you normally would here, or as we normally would here in the States. And I picked that up pretty quickly, but, the pedals, of course, were no issue because they're exactly where they are in the cars here on the left side.
Uh-huh.
Driving on the left, I thought that was going to give me a lot of issue, but it comes relatively easily. There were a few times when I thought maybe I'm on a one-way road. I wasn't quite sure. And then, it was consoled by the fact that I saw a sign facing the correct way. Because, there might be a car parked on the wrong side of the road or something, and it leads you just for an instant to think, am I on a one-way road? Am I on the wrong side at this point? You know, you have to quickly go through these thoughts, you know, and realize like, okay, I'm doing the right thing here.
And speaking of going quickly through some thoughts, listeners, you may have noticed that our intro here is a little bit longer than our usual intros. However, do not be deceived, because today, for the first time ever, Scott, you and I are embarking upon a different kind of podcast, as we mentioned in the beginning, and that is a podcast called One More Thing.
One More Thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be just kind of a somewhat rapid-fire show, in where we go through many different topics. You know, we're not going to do any listener mail in this one like we do in Nuts and Bolts typically.
Right.
And we'll come back to Nuts and Bolts.
But
this one more thing, you know, you've heard us say that many times over the years.
Multiple times in the same episodes.
Like, oh, there's just one more thing I want to tell you. This is kind of a catch-all, and it's maybe not even so much, you know, stuff that we forgot in other podcasts, like, you know, there's that, you know, those facts in the Dale that, you know, we forgot to mention in that episode. I came back in another episode and said, just one more thing I want to tell you about that.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not so much that, but more like stuff I see or questions that I want to ask you, questions you want to ask me.
Yeah.
Just kind of things that are, you know, hanging out there that aren't full episodes themselves.
Right. Yes. That's a really great way to put it too, because there are plenty of things where we have kicked around an idea for an episode and said, I don't know, maybe there's not enough there to put out a full episode on.
Exactly, like this whole thing with, you know, the driving on the wrong side and all that.
Which is fascinating.
The only thing, I mean, and there's a lot more to this, and I'm going to cut it very short here,
sure.
But the only thing that really gave me an issue the entire time I was driving was that since I was on the right-hand side of the car, driving on the left side of the road, I couldn't gauge where the left front edge of the car was. And it was, to begin with, it was a bigger car than what I'm used to driving here in the States, so slightly bigger.
Yeah.
That was already one small issue, but then it's so different on that side trying to gauge the front left versus being on the left and trying to gauge where the front right is, because I can do that with just about any vehicle.
Also, the roads are much tighter there too, right?
So narrow. So when I'm driving, you know, on a backcountry road, and in Ireland, they have either a stone wall on the side, you know, right to the very edge of the road, right where the white line would normally be.
Yeah.
Or there's brush that's cut in a almost like a wall. It's flat. And then if you've got a truck coming the other way on an already narrow, you know, passageway.
Yeah.
I was favoring more towards the left side, you know, towards the brush.
Right.
And there were a couple of brushes with some of the branches and things, but minor. I didn't tear the mirror off or anything like that.
Right.
And there wasn't any scuffs on the car, and I didn't hit any curbs or anything like that, but the left front side is just really, really difficult to gauge when you're on the other side of the car.
Oh man.
And that's about all I have to say about that. It was a unique experience. I mean, hopefully I'll do it again sometime. It was fun. I really liked it. I recommend it if you get a chance to ever do it. It's not as difficult as you may think.
Did you have any of those Jesus take the wheel moments?
No, nothing like that. I never closed my eyes and prayed or anything like that. You know, it worked out okay, and I'll tell you, I was pretty relieved when I returned the car unscathed though.
Yeah. And kudos to you, though, for doing it, because in a lot of travel environments, the only way you can really get to see stuff off the beaten path, as mm-hmm. it were, is to rent your own transportation.
And somehow we did, and it was totally worth it. It was maybe the best 3 days of the entire trip.
So I've got something I wanted to start off with that I don't know, I didn't think it was quite a full podcast, but it's so interesting, and maybe it's a blog post too. And that is one of my favorite people, the current living Uber inventor of the United States in the automotive world, the real life Iron Man. That's right, Elon Musk, head of Tesla Motors, owner, founder of PayPal, all that slow jazz. He did something amazing quite recently, and you've heard of this, right?
Well, what is it?
He said, you know what? Patents are killing innovation, and he's got this great blog post about it.
Patents are killing innovation.
He said patents are killing innovation, and so he decided that Tesla's company, right, Tesla Motors, is not defined by these patents, and he said, listen, every other person in the world if you want to use these patents to make better electric cars, to make electric cars, go ahead.
Wow. Usually people protect those with their life. I mean, that's the patents are what keep an industry or a business going, right?
Right. Here, if I could just read part of this from
sure.
this blog post.
Of course.
All right. He says, when I started out with my first company, Zip2, I thought patents were a good thing and worked hard to obtain them. And maybe they were good long ago, but too often these days they serve merely to stifle progress, entrench the positions of giant corporations, and enrich those in the legal profession rather than the actual inventors. After Zip2, when I realized that receiving a patent really just meant that you bought a lottery ticket to a lawsuit, I avoided them whenever possible. And he said, you know, he goes on to say, I'll paraphrase this part. He said at Tesla, they felt like they had to make patents out of concern that big car companies would copy their technology and then use their manufacturing, sales, and marketing power to overwhelm Tesla. And he said, we couldn't have been more wrong. Electric car programs at the major manufacturers are small to non-existent, far less than 1% of their total vehicle sale. So they said it's impossible for Tesla alone to build electric cars fast enough to address the carbon crisis, which is very important to Elon Musk.
So he's saying for the better good, ignore these patents and let's just make this whole thing work because I believe in it that much.
Yep. Our true competition is not the small trickle of non-Tesla electric cars being produced, but rather the enormous flood of gasoline cars pouring out of the world's factory every day. So he's trying to nudge the rest of the market along. So
that's crazy,
huh?
This is the first time I've heard this. This is pretty remarkable. I mean, he's flying in the face of everything that every big business has ever said, really, because the patents are, again, like I said, that's what keeps their business or their industry going, is that they've got the patent on something and they're able to produce something that no one else can.
Yeah, in their Palo Alto headquarters, they had a wall of all the patents that they had racked up for Tesla, which, you know, if you've listened to any of our earlier podcasts on Tesla, you know already that they have an enormous amount of innovation.
It's a remarkable machine. It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, so for him to say, please use this as you need to in order to make something that truly works. That's remarkable. That's really cool.
One last quote, and
sure.
we'll leave it here, just
okay.
because I could talk way too long about this one, and
well,
we want to do rapid fire. So,
okay.
Here's one of my favorite quotations from what Musk said about setting his patents free for everyone. What we are doing is a modest thing, he said. You want to be innovating so fast that you invalidate your prior patents in terms of what really matters. It's the velocity of innovation that matters.
Hmm. All right.
I like that.
Interesting. Yeah, very cool. I'm going to look that up and read the entire thing. All right. I've got two that I'd like to do together
because
they kind of relate. One, and this is really inconsequential, really. I mean, what happened was recently, and this is an unusual thing that happened, I ran over a complete sealed headlight system with my car one morning on the way into work.
What?
Yeah, somebody in front of me in traffic, and I didn't know this, somebody in front of me in heavy, heavy traffic in downtown Atlanta ran into each other. They bumped
sure,
together.
Okay.
And the headlight system from, hang on one second, I'll tell you what it is. A Toyota 4Runner. That was what it was, the vehicle. And I'll find this out later.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell
okay.
you how I found this out. The entire left front headlight had fallen out of this thing and not broken on the ground. So it's laying there complete, you know, like those big assemblies that you get, you know, the full
yeah.
thing, everything.
Weird.
Sealed system. It didn't break. Now, the car in front of me went around it to the right, and I was going straight ahead, didn't see it until the last second, and I hit it with my left front wheel and my left rear wheel. But when the left front hit it, it sounded like an explosion. I tell you,
wow.
it was just like a huge bang. I had no idea what happened. It's kind of like, you know, I ducked my head down and I was like, what is going, you know, like where your
yeah.
shoulders go up, like almost stopped. I didn't stop. I kept rolling, but I pulled into the next parking lot and I thought, what the heck? Well, I still didn't know what it was even because I just saw something that I hit and I figured it was my tire blowing out or something.
Right. That's what it would sound like.
So
right?
I parked the car and I walked back on the sidewalk and I looked in the lane of traffic where I was.
Yeah.
And there was glass spread for a good, I don't know, 7 to 10 feet. On either side, like it had blown out left and right, you know, across the lane mm-hmm. of traffic. So I had hit this thing just dead solid right in the middle, and the noise that it made, because it's a sealed system, was so intense. I thought, I really didn't know if like my back glass had shattered or the window or the wheels had popped or what.
Yeah.
No damage at all to my tires. The tires stayed inflated. I thought I was going to have a flat tire, but in the parking lot then, and this is how I know it was that vehicle.
Yeah.
I saw the two guys talking that had the accident, and I saw the vehicle that had the missing headlamp. So I understood where it came from then.
Okay.
You know, that it had just happened. They were still discussing, you know, insurance or whatever. And this kind of dovetails into the next one, which I did not have to get new tires or anything. But the other day I was driving past, and this is kind of a word of caution, I guess, to our listeners.
All right.
The other day I was passing a used tire place. You know, they sell new and used.
Right.
And the used tire salesman, I feel like I may have mentioned this before, Ben, but because this is the second time I've seen this ever in my life.
All right.
The guy had a stack of used tires out there. And, you know, you see these on trucks all the time.
Sure.
Going to and from. You wonder where they're going to. Usually you're thinking the junkyard, but they're
right.
not.
They're going straight to that used tire
place. That's right, on the shelf, right? So the guy has them stacked up, like, on top of each other in a column. And he has in his hand a car spray paint gun. Like, you know, for, like, that they,
Are you serious? They
would use to paint a vehicle. You know, the typical air compressor type gun,
right?
He's painting the tires flat black. So all these tires that, you know, come in that, you know, they're of questionable amount of tread, you know, they've got very, very thin tread, but when they arrive, they're all gray and dried out and cracked and everything.
Yeah.
The cracks are still there if you look carefully enough, but he's painting them a flat black. So, you know, the tread surface and some of the surrounding edges of them, right?
Yeah, some of the wall.
He's making them appear much better. I'm sure that he's doing the walls at some point. You know, he lines them up a different way to paint those, but I just thought that'd be a word of caution to people that, you know, you go there and you think like, this tire looks brand new and it's only $20. What's, you know, what gives? The tread's worn out, but it looks like it, you know, it's a brand new tire built this year or whatever. They may be a lot older than you thought because the tires that he had not yet sprayed were like a light gray, you know, because they were sun faded and cracked and bleached and everything. But he was making them look brand new again. So, and I know I'm not the only one that's seen this. You know, I know that people know this happens and I should have, you know, remembered this because I saw it years ago, I think.
Yeah.
You know, them doing the same thing, but it caught me again. And I think it's a good trick, I guess. It's a pretty slick, it's a slick trick, but you got to really watch out for stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. One of the best ways for people to avoid this. First off, there's nothing wrong with going to used tire place. It can be expensive to get new tires.
No, I totally agree.
I
you know what? Recently, I just bought two used tires for my wife's vehicle. She's going to trade it in.
Yeah.
Had a couple of bald tires. We did the rotation and swap with two used ones that were better than her used ones.
Yeah. And that's something that quite a few people do. And it all depends on what you want from your car, right? Like you're not going to use tires if you're racing, but if you're just using something for your daily driver, buying used tires is fine. One of the best ways to avoid that kind of trick is don't be content just to listen to the person's description of the tires that they want to put on your car. What you need to do is see them yourself before they take your old tires off. You know?
Yeah, because they'll walk you in the back room and show you what they have available. They'll say, I have two of these or I have four of these, and here's how they match. You know, you can take them out in the sunlight and take a good look at them, make sure they're not cracked or, you know, old like the ones I mentioned.
Yeah, don't be afraid to do that because if they're reputable, they won't mind you doing it.
And don't be afraid to walk away either. There have been times in my past, Ben, when I've bought used tires almost exclusively. You know, I went from used set to used set to used set.
Yeah.
And honestly, they last so long that I didn't feel like it was a bad deal. Like after three sets, you know, would it have been better to buy one new set?
Mm-hmm.
I think I got more out of the three sets than I would have out of, you know, one new set because there was still so much tread left on these things. And it was at a time when I just didn't have the money to put into new tires.
Right.
Because they're very expensive. So, don't be afraid to walk away and definitely look at what you're buying first.
So I've got another one here that dovetails really nicely into this. And that is four of the most expensive car problems.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Four of the most expensive.
Uh-huh.
Hmm.
Okay, so number four, air conditioning compressor. And we all know what an AC compressor does. It allows the air to cool inside of the car, separates high and low pressure air, where, you know, it can help the Freon do its work, cooling you down. It can malfunction due to a rod or valve inside the compressor or another part of your car, like the engine belt. Something happens with that. That can make your compressor malfunction.
Those things are so finicky.
They are so touchy.
And so expensive.
Yeah. Anywhere between $200 and $600, depending on your car, depending on what makes it go wrong.
And that's probably just the part price.
Yeah, that's not the labor. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So then we've got, of course, head gasket. The word head gasket has just probably inspired terror in numerous car drivers just in the last 24 hours, right?
Probably. That's right. That's something that you hear a lot about. You know, the head gasket goes so that it's the thing that keeps the oil and coolant from mixing together as they travel through your engine.
Right.
And that typically goes bad. I mean, unless you've got a like a racing copper version of this,
yeah.
You know, these things are just made of neoprene or whatever they are. And you know, sometimes they'll have a little bit of copper in them or some type of fiber.
Sure.
But it's something that notoriously goes bad in cars, and it's a huge job to get to it.
Yeah, it's a huge pain in the keister to get to. Just to get to inside your engine, and it can cause disastrous consequences fairly quickly. We're talking discolored oil, leaking coolant, the engine will start puffing out white smoke like, they just chose a new pope or something. It is bad news all around, especially when you start thinking about the cost of this guy, which can easily be, between $1,200 and $1,600.
And see, that's the labor. Because
that's
the labor. I've had jobs done on my vehicles where either, I can't remember now, Ben, if it was like the head gasket had gone and they said, well, let's do this and this, because to get to this point, you have to pretty much to remove the front end of the vehicle.
Right.
So, you know, in that particular vehicle, it was an Audi.
Yeah.
So you had to do a lot of work to get to it. I can't remember if it was that went bad or something else. And it was like, well, we're here. Let's do it now, because the cost to get back to this point is going to be so restrictive that you're not going to want to do it in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't even get me started on the accessibility or lack thereof when it comes to Audi engine.
Yeah.
All right. So number two, transmission replacement. This is a huge pain. There are a lot of drivers even now who are just playing that game. How long can I ride this transmission out? You know, I don't blame anybody, because it can be tough, right?
Mm-hmm.
The cost of a new transmission can be devastating. That's an average of $1,800 to $3,500 for a replacement.
Ooh,
yeah.
Ouch.
That's deceptive, because it's an average.
Yeah, but what if you get a used transmission from somewhere that they just have one on the shelf?
Yeah.
The problem is you don't know if it's going to have all the gears, if it's going to really work when they put it in.
Right.
You've never really gone through, they may not have gone through that. It's just a used one sitting there that they can throw in.
Well, clutch or transmission repair is another option too.
Yeah, sure. Okay. This is a slippery slope to go on, because there's so many different variables with this thing. You know, like what you get, really. Have they opened it up and checked it all out and put it back in? Because that's going to be more expensive than the one I mentioned that comes off the junker, you know, that they throw on a shelf and they keep it there for 10 years. And then someone comes in and says, hey, yeah, I do have a Buick that I need to transfer. So, that's right. We've got one in the back corner of the shop. It's been here for 6 years.
Yeah, we call it Old Faithful.
It's always been here.
The number one, this should not surprise anybody, the blown motor.
Ah, yes. Okay. I could figure that one. Engine and trans, I kind of knew those were going to be top one and two.
But we're talking a blown engine can come from broken rod, damaged valve, leaking oil. Sometimes your car has just way too many miles on it, and that's when you really start to see the benefits or the problems of all the little things you did or did not do to take care of your car.
Sure. Oil consumption becomes an issue because, you know, the rings are wearing out, and you know, the sleeves have got some grooves, nice grooves in them, and lots of oil's blowing through there, and you're burning oil. And it can be, again, same slippery slope as with transmissions. You know, like the one little thing happens, and then another and another, and it becomes a bigger and bigger problem. And I put these in the exact same category with, you can buy the used one that's on the shelf and take your chances. Gamble, or you can get one for a lot more money that they've gone through and made sure that everything is solid, and put it in there. I don't know. It's a matter of comfort at that point. What you're going to do with the vehicle, you know, you plan to hang on to it, you plan to sell it. It becomes a numbers game.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at, like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia,
Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways I imagine you haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Margaret Atwood, Questlove, Cate Blanchett, and Oscar Isaac. If that sounds like a varied group of people, it's because it is. I always wanted to make a show where one week we could sit with a politician like Beto O'Rourke, the next an author like Min Jin Lee, or TV titans like Bill Hader and Quinta Brunson. Basically, this is a podcast driven by curiosity and an abundance of research. Conversations where people actually start to sound like people. In recent weeks, I sat with Dan Levy, Ava DuVernay, Benny Safdie, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
That's the big thing to say. That's exactly what it is. I would describe it more as a numbers game, because we do have some podcasts that can help you out with that if you ever have that moment where you say, well, my car is X number of years old, mm-hmm. and the repair is Y number of dollars. Mm-hmm. So at what point is it worth the money to buy a different car?
When am I saving money, and when am I actually blowing through all my saved up cash? All right, so Ben, I got one here that this is more something that I just have seen.
Oh, good. Okay? Stuff's got C's.
Yeah, I guess this is Stuff's got C's, I suppose. But this is unusual, and it's not a joke. This really happened. Last Tuesday, I was out at lunch from here, from this office, and I was out on Peachtree Road, which is right in front of our office, and of course, Peachtree Road in Atlanta, how many are there? There's 36 or whatever it is.
Right, but, yeah.
Or 56. This is so strange, Ben. I saw a car driving down Peachtree Road. It went through the intersection right in front of me with the gas pump stuck in the, in the filler.
No.
And I thought, and my initial thought, and cause I only saw this for about 4 seconds, my initial thought was it's one of those gag ones, right? Because it had a green handle and it had a length of hose to it. But the thing I know that the reason I know this is real, it had about 8 feet of hose with it, and the coupler was still attached to it, and that was skipping along on the pavement.
Oh, my gosh.
And people around this person, like,
honking their horns,
honking as they went through the intersection to try to get the person's attention. I was so distracted by seeing this happen, because in my life, I've never seen this happen. I've heard stories of it, and I've seen the joke version that has, you know, the handle and a, you know, maybe a 2 foot section of hose.
Right, yeah.
That's kind of tattered at one end. That's not really how it happens. It breaks at that coupler. You know, there's a coupler designed to break free that cuts off the gas flow at the pump, so there's no fire damage.
Right, yeah, and that's, you can see that linkage. Next time you're getting gas, if you look up, it'll usually be at the top of the installation.
Yeah.
Right?
And so this hose that's trailing along, it's about 8 feet long, maybe longer, and it's skipping along the pavement, and I was so distracted by it. I know it was a red car. I don't know what kind of car it was. I didn't see who's driving. I couldn't even take any of that in, because I was just looking at that pump trying to figure, is that real? And I saw people next to me at the light, you know, on either side of me, kind of chuckling to each other and, like, you know, forehead slapping, like, yeah. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I just saw that. And really, that's the first time in my life I'd ever seen that in person, you know, without it being some kind of joke. But it's a strange thing. It does happen, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You got to be so absent-minded for something like that to occur.
Well, everybody has their off days.
I guess so. You know, never say never, right? I mean, I like to think that would never happen to me, because I don't get back in the vehicle after I'm filling right. the tank. But I guess, again, never say never. You never know what happens.
The worst thing that most people have done is driving with your gas cap still open.
Yeah, I
people
see that.
Have done that before.
Yeah, I see that happen a lot. That's it's pretty common. Or you leave it on the pump, you know, if it's one that doesn't connect to the vehicle.
Yeah.
I see that a lot where I pull in and the person before me had left their gas cap on the pump. And I think, man, that's an expensive mistake because if they don't come back for it, it's probably, you know, a $20 cap because there's a lot of venting. They're all very specific now.
Right.
It's not just a generic cap. It's got, you know, specific venting and even a size even. A lot of them are different sizes.
Nice proprietary features that are just different enough.
Yeah, just enough that you have to buy them from the dealer or, you know, maybe an aftermarket place. But expensive mistake. All right, so let's get back to our one more thing discussion. And there's something that I'd like to talk about real quickly here, Ben. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this one at all. But there's something that I've been doing for many, many years. And I have a feeling that a lot of our listeners do the same thing.
All right.
And check me if I'm wrong in this, Ben. But when I go into a restaurant or a smaller business, let's say like a print shop or wherever I'm going, okay?
Yeah.
When I go in and as I'm parking, I'll see a car outside, like maybe an unusual vehicle, something that's maybe it's a car that has like an airbrushed Firebird on the hood, you know, it's a custom van, you know, from the 1970s, or it's a really cool Mustang, or you know, I go into a restaurant and last month I went to a restaurant and there was an Audi R8 parked outside that had like full carbon fiber race kit on it, like a wide body kit on an R8, and as I walk into the restaurant or business or whatever, I try to figure out who owns that specific vehicle. It's like I'm car profiling as I walk in.
Yeah.
I see one vehicle, I focus on that, and then I go in and I say, okay, now as I'm looking around, who owns that car? Who's the individual that I can look at? And I don't ask anybody, I don't say anything, but I try to keep an eye on who leaves the restaurant. And if I can see it, if I can see when they leave, or if I happen to be walking out at the same time, a small place or whatever, I always try to figure out who owns that specific vehicle based on the way they appear, the way they're talking, the way they look, whatever it is. Just I can, and I'm getting pretty good at this. I can pick out like, all right, here's a Mustang convertible from 1990. You know, who owns that classic Fox body Mustang that's there? That you know, which one of these people, these 12 people that's in this restaurant, owns that? And I can usually get it, or you know, even out of these 30 people, who owns that? I can usually pick the person.
You know, that's really interesting because I know that some people do that with dogs as well.
Really?
Like, who owns that dog?
Huh.
Yeah, I've seen that before
at a dog park. Yeah.
At a dog park.
Huh.
I've played that game with cars, of course, especially for me, it's always when there's a car that stands out either as a fantastic, top of the line, unique car or the complete opposite spectrum.
Yeah, a POS.
You know, right, yeah. Who brought this POS bound by only duct tape and prayers all the way to this convenience store, and what are they buying today?
And so you do the same thing, and how would you say you are on accuracy?
On accuracy, when I've been able to verify it, I have definitely gotten better over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty good now. However, there's still a couple curveballs, you know?
Now, I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one that does this, and I would assume that a lot of our listeners do this type of thing, because if there's a standout vehicle, and it can't just be like, okay, who owns that gray sedan over there?
No.
Because that
and
could be,
how would you guess?
That could be anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, really anybody. But who's bringing, you know, the Indy 500 pace car Corvette here? You know, who has that one? You know, who's driving that specific vehicle today?
Uh-huh.
And try to pick them out either based on the way they're dressed, the way they're acting, the way they're talking.
Yeah.
Or just simply the way they look. I'm pretty good at this now.
I could totally see you being fantastic at it. I would have to ask though, have you ever used stickers, like bumper stickers as a clue?
No, I don't think I have.
Bumper stickers are a huge clue because, you know, I personally don't care for bumper stickers and I've never put them on my own cars.
Same here.
But for a lot of people, it's a way for them to convey their identity or something.
Now, you say bumper stickers. Now, what I have done, anybody that knows me is going to realize, like, well, I have put stickers on my car.
Uh-huh.
I want to be clear about this.
Uh-huh.
Pre-Fast and the Furious movie days, you know, like, the new versions of Fast and Furious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'd throw a few racing stickers on my cars and stuff like that, you know, like things that I thought were really cool. And it looked neat, and it was kind of fun to do. Not a lot of people were doing it at the time. Now it's become, well, for a while it was a huge trend, And that's about when I stopped doing it. And it wasn't just because of that. It's just I felt kind of silly then at that point. I didn't want to be part of that whole thing. I was doing it before that. And, you know, I don't know. Some people didn't really agree with it. Some people thought it was a little silly, a little goofy. I can show you some photo examples of it if you want later. But I don't know if people could profile me based on those as well. And maybe they could have. Said, yeah, this is the clown that has, you know, the racing stickers on his, you know, Honda CRX outside.
I don't know if people are judging you that harshly for it, man. No. Those kind of racing stickers are pretty popular.
Well, you know, at the time they were not. I'm talking like early 90s. Early.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they make a car look good as long as they're well done.
Yeah, well, they were. I would say that they were. It wasn't a sloppy job. I always took a lot of time with them. I was very meticulous with this
whole
thing.
Yeah, you better. Because nothing makes a car look as clownish as
I've shown you my Festiva.
Yep.
You remember that vehicle?
Uh-huh.
I did all that work myself. So that's one example.
Not bad. I didn't know you did them yourself.
All right.
I've got one.
Okay.
For our one more thing here. This is interesting. Every so often, because you and I feel that we want to be responsible to our listeners and cover every aspect of car driving, car ownership, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's our continuing mission,
sure,
to quote Star Trek. We've talked about one of the less fascinating topics for a lot of people, but it's a necessary evil, and that is car insurance. So I took a look at the most expensive car insurance in the United States.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And, most expensive.
And it goes by city, right?
Okay.
Broken down by city primarily. So I have to ask you, do you have a guess for number one?
My guess, I'm going to guess one of two cities.
Okay.
Can I do that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. I'm going to say New York or Chicago.
Those are both good guesses. The correct answer is Detroit.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Oh, why was I thinking of Detroit? Okay.
The average annual premium is a little under $11,000.
Whoa. Now, I know that when I came here from Detroit, I was in the Detroit metro area, not in downtown. I got a significant break in my insurance.
Yeah.
I mean, it cut in half between Detroit and Atlanta.
Well, part of that is because, yeah, Atlanta's number 26 on the list.
Oh, okay. Right, in the middle.
Part of that is that drivers in Detroit have high insurance rates because there's a high crime rate in Detroit, and also Michigan has a little bit of a wonky no-fault insurance system.
Yes, they do.
Right? So under the state law in Michigan, which is a good thing to know if you're not from Michigan, because I did not know this, insurance companies have to pay medical expenses, lost wages, and property damage regardless of who caused the accident.
Yeah, and you pay for it on the front end, I'll tell you that, because as you said, even a basic plan is relatively expensive there.
Right, and nobody has set a cap on the claim rewards yet, or awards.
Oh, boy.
So this is not uniformly high, though. The study that I was reading found that these premiums varied greatly. So in Rosedale Park, for instance, State Farm would give you a policy for $25,000 a year, while another insurance place, Hanover, would give you insurance for a little bit under $5,000.
Yeah. Aren't those numbers are crazy high, aren't they?
Yeah, they're crazy high.
I mean, when we know how much they are here, now it would shock people from that area to look up rates in other states, and maybe they haven't done that, but it would probably be an exercise that would make you very mad if you did that, because you'd realize just how much you're overpaying for that insurance.
Right. Yeah, just for just to spend a second on this, the other things here that might surprise people is that Detroit's average annual premium is more than twice as high as the second highest.
Really? So they're way, way out in front.
Yeah. New Orleans, second highest, 4,300 something.
Is it because of crime and location, I bet? Because there's probably a good chance that your vehicle is going to be a flood-damaged vehicle at some point in New Orleans.
Right, yeah. It has some of the worst roads in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it also has, yeah, you're right about the crime. Hate to point out, but you are totally right about the crime. It also has a state law that allows people to directly sue insurance companies after an accident.
Okay, so there's in both of those instances, like you said, in Michigan, there's no cap on the amount of, I guess, money that you can receive from the insurance company.
Right.
And in this one, you said, what was the?
You can sue the insurance company directly.
So both of those leave them wide open for lawsuits and
right.
And for lots of money being poured out of the system.
Which is why still in the top five. Another Michigan city, Grand Rapids, is number three, and Baton Rouge is number five.
Interesting.
Yep, and
I wonder if Flint, Michigan, makes it on the list there anywhere.
Let's see. I don't see Flint, so it's not in the top 30 at least. Hmm. But I do know that, as we said, Atlanta is number 26 with an average insurance price of $2,224. Wow. Again, just to be safe, you guys. Whenever you hear an average like this about something that's such a big place, you have to be very careful because averages can be deceiving. Mm-hmm. And you know what's interesting here, Scott? Chicago is on the list, and New York City is right under it, and that's number 12 and 13 on the list, respectively. So
relatively high in there, but I thought those were going to be number 1 and 2.
You would think so, with all the opportunities to have horrific accidents.
That's right. And just the congestion and, you know, they kind of don't want you to drive in New York City, it almost seems like. I mean, they want you to use public transportation.
Yeah.
It seems like that. I know that, you know, that's a pretty negative way to look at it, but it seems like that when I was there.
Yeah, the cost for a parking spot in some areas of Manhattan is more expensive than the average cost of an apartment in some other cities.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Super expensive. Now, Ben, I want to tell you that I've got a couple here that I want to wrap up with at the very end. And
okay.
I'm only teasing this because they're probably the two most interesting ones that I've got for my entire day here, my entire podcast. So
okay.
I'll tell you the two that I want to wrap with, but I've got a couple more that I'd like to hit real quick if I can.
Yeah.
And there's one that, you know, it's bigger, but I'm gonna scale it way back and I'm gonna let the listeners kind of look into this and make their, you know, develop their own theory about this.
All right.
Do you remember when we first started this whole podcast way back in 2008? Do you remember that fuel prices were just skyrocketing? It was like $5 a gallon.
Oh yeah, it was spiking heavily.
$4.25 was the norm, and somewhere up to $5, it was like there was all types of weather issues, and you know, the fuel. It was like a fuel crisis, a mini fuel crisis.
Absolutely, that's
fair. And if you also recall, they were talking about ethanol and biofuels and
flex fuel,
all types of flex fuel. That's all the same thing. And they're talking about alternative fuels. And there was this huge push that how are we going to make sawdust into
right.
gasoline, and how are we going to use old diapers for gasoline. And you know, there's all these just crazy ideas about what they're going to use for fuel.
Right.
And one of the big things they talked about was aerodynamics. You know, they got to improve aerodynamics on vehicles, and we really need to push on this. And the thing that happened was a lot of sites popped up overnight, pretty much. They were offering aerodynamic add-ons for cars and trucks. And I was thinking about this because I was on this longer road trip this past weekend to Indiana.
Yeah.
And I drove up, you know, it was like an 11-hour one-way trip. And when I was on my way there and back, I saw a lot of aerodynamic add-ons on trucks, semi-trucks, you know, tractor trailers. And I was thinking, all right, well, they've kept this idea up the whole time because they're adding things like, these rear fairings that add an extra 5 feet to the back end of the vehicle
right.
that kind of folds out. I'm sure you've seen them.
Yeah.
A loose framework. It's not even enclosed or anything. It's just, you know, four, great big sheets of material. I don't know if it's plastic or what they are, metal.
Yeah.
But it increases the airflow over the back end of the vehicle. It creates less drag.
Right. It decreases the drag coefficient.
Exactly. And they've got things like aero mirrors, and they've got, you know, these, the fairings, I guess, that go over the roof cab and,
yeah.
you know, the fairings that go between the cab and the trailer. They've got those giant ones now that everybody has seen, I'm sure, that go along the side of it between the wheels. You know, the long distance between the cab and the
right.
and the back end, or on the trailer rather. So they've really kept up this idea. But for a while, there was a short time when people were thinking that we're going to need to increase aerodynamics on cars to the point where we're going to have to start adding things like that to our own personal vehicles. And so these people sold things like, unusual aerodynamic devices that you could add on to your car that you already own.
Yeah, I remember some of those. Like, there's one that kind of angles up from the hood. to the windshield.
Sure, right? It was almost like a giant bug shield or something.
Yeah.
That, you know, we see on trucks again that you know keeps the bugs off the windshield, but it's also an aerodynamic advantage because it creates less turbulent airflow over the vehicle. Well, there's an article that I was looking at from 2009, and it was in Popular Mechanics, and I was thinking about, you know, how all these things have gone away, and the article, it's kind of funny because it says, five real DIY aerodynamic mods that Detroit can add for miles per gallon in 2009.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they thought, well, sure, you know, automakers have made cars more aerodynamic as time goes on because that's kind of the way that we've talked about, you know, they're able to get more mileage to meet these CAFE standards.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They've done just about everything they can with the current engine configurations that they've got. They're trying to eke every little mile per gallon out of them. Aerodynamics and lightweight are the way that they're trying to gain even more. And that's where the significant gains are going to be in the near future. So how many of these have we seen from Detroit since 2009?
Huh.
And did they do them in 2009? Here's five that, people were doing on their own with kind of, you know, just materials they find in their house, or they can go to Home Depot and buy these things.
Lay it on me.
All right. Now I'll go through them quickly. Grill aero treatments, like where the person blocks off the entire front end of the vehicle. And then they have a small vent that they can control airflow through, and that's it. The entire front end of the vehicle becomes flat, like you would have on an EV, because they don't require airflow through the vehicle like a standard IC engine would.
Oh, I just want to point out, those things look really cool, too.
They kind of do, yeah. I mean, I'm looking at this one right now, and it's on, I don't know, it looks like a Honda CRX or something.
Yeah.
They've got the whole front end blocked off with this tiny little vent. But yeah, it looks pretty neat. It gives it more of a race car appearance, really.
Yeah, heck yeah.
But that's something that we don't see a lot of people doing, is blocking the entire front end of the vehicle for good reason.
Right.
That will cause a lot of problems quick. Truck bed caps, and it's not the kind that we're thinking of.
Right. Yeah, it's not, I can see because you got the picture here. It's angled. It's a wedge.
It's not a camping bag like you would think, though. This is not really for cargo, even though you can put cargo in it, but this is more of an angular thing that creates the back end makes the back end look more like a teardrop.
Yeah, that's a really good way to say it. It gives it a smoother profile.
Exactly right. And that's for any truck. And this one happens to be handmade. You know, you have access to the back and everything, but it's not about, you know, like camping or it's not squared off in any way. It's definitely angular. This one ties in with that, and it's for cars. It's a boat tail design that somebody has made out of Bondo. And that is the back end of a Honda CRX.
You know, I'm impressed with the craftsmanship, just looking at it, like that's a nice sculpt. I mean, you can definitely tell it's Bondo.
This part, part that I'm looking at here has been sculpted and smoothed. There's a part that's still rough that they're not finished with yet, but the sculpted and smooth part has integral tail lamps. It looks like part of the vehicle itself, and it's actually really, really well done. But I haven't seen even one of these, Ben. I haven't seen anybody adding a boat tail to their car for aerodynamic purposes.
No, I haven't seen it on the road.
But we've seen it in car designs. You know, we've seen that, you know, the Prius, of course, has that type of design almost.
Yeah.
I think, is that the right way to say it? Maybe not a boat tail design.
It has a tapered end.
Yeah, there's a...
That's a better way to say it.
There's a term for that. There's a geometrical form that they use for that, but I can't remember what it is now. But another thing that they use is wheel skirts.
I've seen those,
Now, I have too, and I've actually seen this one where they put pie pans on the wheels in order to reduce drag for the wheels, but I'm talking about wheel skirts, and it's not a new idea. That's something that comes from the 1930s.
Right.
And you can imagine that, you know, early on they did them for aerodynamic purposes, and then they did them for style, as we all know, all the way through the 1960s, maybe even the early 1970s. My Chrysler has wheel skirts, but that's strictly style thing.
That's what I was going to say. There's a style thing for a lot of people.
And it's typically rear wheels only, front wheels because they have to turn. They can't really enclose them unless they do kind of like an exterior fender type thing that moves with it. But, I don't see people adding, you know, sheet metal or plastic or whatever wheel skirts to their car like they thought that we were going to back in 2009.
Well, you know, just one note on that real quick. Some of my buddies who do mods, they put them on their cars, but they put them on purely for a stylistic thing.
Really?
Yeah. So that back panel is seamless.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's just, it has, a factory. That's always their goal, to make it look factory.
You know,
right?
That
kind of stuff.
That can be a real cool look. I mean, it's neat, and it has benefits too. I mean, it has the aerodynamic benefits. So you gain miles per gallon. People claim that you can gain, there's significant gains from something like that.
Right. Yeah. And let me go ahead and drop the drop a little reference to the elephant in the room, at least on the car manufacturer side, even post that gas price crisis, car manufacturers have always maintained that it would be super easy for them to build a car that gets, you know, 55 plus per gallon if they didn't have to comply with regulatory demands.
Oh, they could go far higher than that, I think, because just think about the weight of all these added systems that they have to include now. And every year, every year there's more, and that's what it all comes down to.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It is saving lives, but I'm saying it's not as if they only have this recourse, the aerodynamic form, right?
I understand. All right, yeah. And the last one here on my list that I want to mention is something that's pretty easy to do, and some manufacturers kind of dabble in this already.
Oh, yeah?
This is the under tray for your vehicle, because the bottom side of a car is the roughest surface of your car,
yep.
And air flows underneath there just as it does over the top of your car, and if you could smooth that out like they do on race cars or like they do on supercars, that is something that can benefit you as far as the way, you know, miles per gallon go. And that was what this article was all about, was increasing miles per gallon. Now, some of these people have made these out of plastic or aluminum, something that's lightweight, of course, and it becomes a bit of a maintenance issue, you know, and that you have to remove that in order to do any kind of maintenance. And you're not immediately conscious of any leaks that you may have underneath the vehicle.
Yeah.
Access is always an issue, but think about there's lots of sports cars with this treatment. Some sedans have, you know, engine compartments that are covered with plastic underneath, you know, just the front part. My Audi again had a tray like that. But you had to remove that in order to do even an oil change. And then there's also off-road vehicles that use plates and skid plates, but those are used for protection. You know, if you're off-roading, that, those are more of a functional thing when you're off-road versus when you're on the highway. They don't really add a whole lot, or maybe even, you know, decrease from your miles per gallon. I don't know, because they're very heavy.
Right.
They're made of steel.
Yeah.
So anyways, I thought it was interesting that, you know, we don't see a lot of these really creeping into manufacturers, you know, wheelhouse, I guess. They're not building new cars with a lot of, you know, wheel skirts and boat tails and things like that. But I know that aerodynamics do play a factor in this whole thing. But we're not seeing exactly what they thought we would in 2009.
Well, the market does as well, and you can only manufacture demand to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So if people don't want to buy a new car with those kind of designs,
mm-hmm.
then of course car makers aren't going to do it unless it's, you know, an explicit mandate.
But I mean, the whole point is that our focus has shifted.
From
2008, everybody thought this was the way to go.
Right.
And you just don't see those sites, and you don't see them profitable if you do see them. You know, they don't, I don't see any of that on the road at all.
Right. And the days of the lumbering, gas-guzzling SUVs are still here, mm-hmm. you know. For a while, we thought that might be sort of the death toll mm-hmm. for those things. But as soon as gas evened down, that gets me to a really interesting one more thing, kind of dovetail, which I don't have too many notes on this one. But one thing that always perplexed me, Scott, is when we would hear about these gas price spikes, right? And they happen at the weirdest times. You know, they're more likely to happen during summer, for instance, mm-hmm. right? But when I was studying international affairs at Georgia Tech on my lunch break, you remember those days, I asked some of our teachers about this stuff, some of the professors, and I asked them, what does OPEC do? You know, what exactly does this consortium of countries do?
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways I imagine you haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Margaret Atwood, Questlove, Cate Blanchett, and Oscar Isaac. If that sounds like a varied group of people, it's because it is. I always wanted to make a show where one week we could sit with a politician like Beto O'Rourke, the next an author like Min Jin Lee, or TV titans like Bill Hader and Quinta Brunson. Basically, This is a podcast driven by curiosity and an abundance of research. Conversations where people actually start to sound like people. In recent weeks, I sat with Dan Levy, Ava DuVernay, Benny Safdie, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I hope to see you there.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
And my professors, who came from all walks, all possible ideologies, et cetera, foreign-born professors, domestic-born professors, they universally said, well, OPEC exists to ensure the profits of the oil producers, right? So that OPEC, from the way they said it, OPEC's, let me think exactly how they said this. OPEC's theoretical goals and theoretical purpose for being, are irrelevant because its actual purpose is to prevent a glut of oil. So to control the amount of oil that hits the market at any one time to prevent the bottom from falling out. And that's when I started to learn something that I think would be a very good podcast for us to do. The price of gasoline per liter or gallon in other countries is, oh buddy, they are, especially in countries, many of which are OPEC countries that have a subsidy on their gasoline.
Sure.
Right. You know, if you're listening to us in Western Europe, then you're paying so many taxes out the wazoo.
Sure. When I was in Ireland.
Yeah.
I figured it out to be just above $6 a gallon, because it was $1.59 per liter. And there's what, 3.875, liters per gallon. It's just over $6 a gallon.
Right. And that's not the highest price in Europe either.
No, not by any means.
So in the United States, of course, there are also various taxes that get tacked on to the price of gallons. But in countries like Iran or Venezuela or Saudi Arabia, you know, big producers, the gasoline is also subsidized, and these people are paying much less.
Yeah.
So I think we should do a podcast on gas price liquidity, because once investors began buying oil futures as well, that's when we really started to see some strange variations.
Well, sure. So OPEC is an intentional bottleneck, is what it is, really.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So they're intentionally slowing it down or allowing that to open up just a bit. So there's some give and take there. It's an interesting thought process that goes behind what they do, really.
It's an interesting business, and I don't blame the countries involved, because if were I on that side of the equation and I was the source of the supply, then I would do the best I could to manufacture continual predictable demand.
Of course, why wouldn't you? Because that's your business. That's what you do.
And this is not like De Beers, one of the other big businesses that does this kind of thing, because most people don't actually need diamonds. Diamonds do have industrial applications for sure, right?
Sure.
But most people don't actually need diamonds.
I don't know, Ben. I mean, some people do need diamonds.
Oh, man.
Some people feel like they need diamonds.
Ah, okay.
Maybe that's the better way to say it.
They're a girl's best friend.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. So, as we've learned from all the advertising for the last 100 years or whatever, right?
I'd love to, but just to put that shout out for our listeners, I'd love to hear, what you guys think about gas prices, both here in the U.S. and in other countries.
All right, Ben. So this is that's a good point. We should do a podcast on that. I agree. Now, I've got a total of about three things left that I'd like to talk about. Actually, four, but I think that one is maybe a bit long for this one. I really wanted to ask you about your Odyssey thing. Why you have such a grudge against Odyssey drivers and owners.
Is that for a new podcast?
Maybe, because okay. I think maybe your answer would be too long. How, you think you could do it quickly?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it quickly then. So what's your grudge with Odyssey drivers? Or the Honda Odyssey itself? I don't know if that's it or not. Is it the people that typically drive them, or is it the vehicle itself? Are you angry about the vehicle, Ben?
You know, that is a great question. First things first, I have nothing against Odysseys. I do have something huge against Odysseys. I have nothing against Honda. Honda makes some phenomenal cars, honestly.
I totally agree.
Like you drive a Civic, right?
I do.
Honda Civic, has been the most popular car in the United States for a while, which also makes it the most stolen car in the United States. But these are cars that were made to be resilient and don't have necessarily obsolescence planned in them.
Remember, this is an engine company that happens to build cars.
Exactly, and thank you for saying that. But Honda Odyssey, nothing against the drivers. I don't know what their demographic would be. Maybe it's just confirmation bias, but Scott, I swear to you, every time that a Honda Odyssey is in front of me, something that's a huge pain in the butt happens. Mm. Either getting cut off so that they can go 30 miles an hour in a place that's clearly marked 45, after the cutoff, which I don't understand, meandering, out-of-towners, tailgating me, which everybody hates when somebody rides on your bumper like
that. Sure, yeah. And you've even had an experience just this week, and I only bring this whole thing up because, you know, you're talking about it again this week with me off air. We've talked about it many times on air. I know, you know, older listeners or listeners that have listened from the very beginning will know that this has come up often.
It's got to be, at this point, man, if I'm just being objective, it has to be something psychological, some sort of selective data that I'm doing in my head, because maybe I'm just not noticing all the hypothetical Honda Odysseys that are not a bane to my existence.
Well, there's a term for that, right? When you're looking for something, or when something's on your mind, you see that more often. And I can't remember what the term is.
Is it Bader-Meinhof?
That is it. That's the one. And you're thinking, all right, you're almost watching for them to screw up. And you're maybe not watching for someone in a different vehicle, like in a Jeep or something like that, to screw up. But they're probably screwing up just as often in front
of them. Well, I probably just have a prejudice. You know, when this first came out, one of our long-term listeners wrote to us and said that she had a prejudice against gold cars.
Mm-hmm.
And she said much the same thing intellectually. I know that it can't just be that, but...
And I've voiced my opinion about, I think it's PT Cruisers that I mentioned specifically. I mean, it just seems like 85% of the time, not all the time,
right?
But 85% or 90% or something like that, I have an issue with it. And gold cars also, and that's another thing. I agree with that. So gold PT Cruiser, that's the worst case scenario, or gold Honda Odyssey for you, right?
Literally. I almost had someone cause an accident in a gold Honda Odyssey.
It's strange. I mean, but I think it is this Bader-Meinhof that you mentioned, because it just gets stuck in your head, and then you're looking for it, and you see it more often than you would with anything else. You almost have a blind spot for other vehicles. And I know our listeners have similar things. They've got their own vehicles. I would, too. Like, what's the one thing that just bothers you every time you're behind the wheel?
Yeah, is there a car or a make a vehicle that you see while you're driving and you go, here we go, one of those?
Yeah, you're just waiting for something to happen, and then invariably, even if it's a little thing, you're like, oh, I knew it. I knew it was going to happen. Look at that.
Well, let me, I hope that wasn't too long of an answer.
No, that's okay.
Let me go with something that might interest people. Scott, you and I have talked about the Peterson Automotive Museum often.
Several times.
Yeah, but we've never done just a podcast on that.
Correct.
There are a couple of vehicles at the Peterson Museum that I thought would be really good to talk about, so I just wanted to give them a shout out. For anyone who doesn't know, the Peterson Automotive Museum is in the Miracle Mile neighborhood of LA on Museum Row. It's one of the largest auto museums in the world, and it's part of a nonprofit organization that specializes in auto history and related educational programs. It's really young, though. It was founded in 1994. Mm-hmm. And this thing has some fantastic vehicles, one of which I had never heard of, which was the 1927 Pedroso.
Pedroso.
Yeah. No. So in the late 1920s, this guy, the Marquis de Pedroso, a wealthy Spaniard living in France, decided to build his own sports car, because that's what you do when you just are born into millions of dollars. And he wanted to build a car of his dreams, so he built this supercharged straight eight, ignition timing, adjustable from the dash, smart chassis. The passenger compartment is closer to the ground for a sportier feel, but it's a very long car with just two seats at the
bare bottom. Wait. The passenger compartment is lower to the ground for stability?
Well, no, for a sportier feel.
That's awesome. This car, I mean, looking at the photo, it's a beautiful car, and that engine is huge. That big straight eight, it's a relatively small sports car with a wide open, you know, the kind of, what do you call those hoods that open like that? They're hinged at two points. They open at two points from the side. I can't remember the name for it. I'll think of it as soon as we turn off this podcast, as soon as we leave this podcast. Uh-huh. But, that engine is gigantic for that small car. That must be a blast to drive.
So, only two Pedrosos were ever built, and this is the only one that survives.
Really?
In the Peterson Museum. But they got this about 12 years ago with full blueprints.
What a collection.
Could build another one if they wanted.
So they got full blueprints for this vehicle. That's maybe one of that's really interesting. So
I'm going to wait on that. I'll save the rest of it.
You know what? That's the kind of thing that, you know, in a few years we'll probably hear that they're undertaking that type of project, because museums sometimes do that.
Wouldn't it be awesome?
Like, remember they rebuilt the Bluebird. Mm-hmm. I remember that was the vehicle that held the speed record.
Yep.
Was it Campbell? Is that the name?
Yeah, it's Campbell.
Campbell, who was breaking the water speed record at the time when he crashed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Coniston Water, is that it?
Yes, Coniston Water. You got it.
Having a difficult time with my memory recently, but that's probably it. Yeah, and they rebuilt that vehicle, and that was like a museum undertaking because they had blueprints.
Yes.
So if they rebuild this Pedroso, what a cool thing that would be. And you know that Jay Leno would get it.
Oh, yeah.
He would buy it.
Oh, man, I hope he listens to the show. Jay, please, help us out here.
What a cool car.
Yeah, it is a really cool
car. All right, well, tell you what, Ben. We're running pretty long on this one because there's so many things. I've got a few more that I'd like to cover, but I'm not going to. But I am going to deliver on the two earlier promises, and with the idea that, you know, listeners can look these up because, I don't know, these two are maybe the most fascinating out of the whole list. And listeners are going to say that, well, your whole list wasn't all that fascinating, Scott. But anyways, these last two are, I think, pretty cool. I'm going to show you a photo of a guy. Pretty ordinary guy, right?
Yeah.
Nothing special about this guy. He's dressed appropriate for the era. I'm going to say, I don't know when this was, 1930s maybe. I'll tell you in just a minute.
Okay.
For sure. Leaning on an umbrella, that's significant. This guy, Ben, the story of this guy, rather, comes from a site called The First Super Speedway. It's firstsuperspeedway.com.
Uh-huh.
I encourage listeners to go there and just take a quick look at this, because this is about a guy that they call the 1905 Rainmaker. Now, what's interesting now, his name is Ned Broadwell, and he is a rainmaker, and he's a guy that was hired to spoil races. He would be hired to go to certain events and just to attend. And by him being there, he could somehow conjure, you know, rain at these different events. Now, there's a reason behind these guys, because there's more than one. Ned was just one of many.
Okay.
Now, in September of 1905, so this goes way, way back, a lot of the automobile trade media was totally against what they called track racing. And that was when they used what was formerly racing courses for horses, for racing cars. Now, this is, you know, the dawn of the automobile, 1905, very, very early on. So, you know, people were accustomed to seeing horse races, but not automobile races on these kind of loose dirt surfaces that they were racing.
Like carriage ruts and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So they were well-groomed. So these are well-groomed tracks, but it was a good place to hold an auto race, they thought. And they were really popular for a lot of reasons, of course, because public roads were really poor at the time, but there were very few paved areas.
Yep.
Second is that because appropriating public roads for auto races always created some type of issue with community leaders because they were seen as frivolous and dangerous at the time because it was a new pastime. No one really knew much about the automobile. The last thing is that charging spectators for observing races on regular roads was almost impossible.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't know how to contain the area. There wasn't a road course set up anywhere. They would run it through town, and they can't charge for it. So that was an issue as well. Well, in 1905, compounding with all of this, there was a huge wreck that that really just almost killed three of auto racing's biggest racers. It was Barney Oldfeld, Webb J., and Earl Kaiser, or Kisser, I think. I think it's Kaiser, K-I-S-E-R, Kaiser.
Oh, yeah.
But they were gravely injured in auto accidents in 1905. And so these religious groups decided, well, we can't have these things going on because, you know, this is it's sacrilegious. We can't have something like this happening. It's the devil's sport, you know, that type of thing, right? I mean, people weren't meant to go this fast. And, so they hired these guys who claimed they could drum up precipitation at a moment's notice, these rainmakers.
Yeah.
And Ned Broadwell was one that they would hire to go to these events. The religious groups would hire to go to these events to spoil them, to prevent them from ever happening. And that was the whole idea. Well, they said that, you know, with a lot of frequency, they would spoil these events. Now, is that just coincidence or what? But the photo here of Ned was taken at the Glenville Horse Racetrack on August 14th, 1905, just 2 days after Kaiser's accident at the same facility. And they say, just for the record, it rained that day.
Huh.
So he was there, and it rained. Now, take what you will from that, but are these rainmakers or these rain, these rain men, I guess?
Sure.
was it worth it for them to do that? And, you know, strange purpose behind it.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Were they only taking assignments when they knew it would rain?
Well, I don't know. What a way to make a living. But, you know, the races were going to happen on a specific day anyways.
Oh, that's right.
And you and I know that races occasionally get rained out anyways.
Yeah,
it's just a random chance thing. It just happens. But interesting little history about those guys.
My very last one before you go into our show ender.
Mm-hmm.
So recently, Scott, our buddies at McLaren announced that they are resurrecting the GTR for a special track-only edition of the P1, and it's a limited-run model, right?
Mm-hmm.
So details are scant, but McLaren says this P1 GTR will have 1,000 horsepower.
1,000 horsepower. Awesome. I love anything that McLaren is doing these days. It seems like they can't do anything wrong. So, you know, if they're saying this is a good program, I'm going to say that, you know, they're probably on the right target with it. You know, they're on the mark. I'm going to have to dig into it and see, you know, all the details.
Yeah.
Still, what a cool thing.
I wanted to ask about it because in our previous episode, you and I had talked about whether McLaren was sandbagging.
Yeah, that's right. We did about the top speed record, right?
Yep.
So are they going to come back at, what was it, the Hennessy Venom GT?
That
holds the current record. Now, are they going to, blast this, that car for top speed, or are they going to go to the Nürburgring and just blow away the top contender there? I can't remember who's number one right now.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Speaking of number one, we have our number one. One more thing.
Yeah, this is the last thing, and I'll make it sort of brief and let you investigate yourself on this one as well. This is maybe the craziest thing I've heard in a while, Ben, and it's something that happened a good 50 years ago.
All right.
All right. In 1962, 1963, and 1964, the city of Chicago held indoor drag racing. Now think about that for just a moment. Indoor drag racing. And I'll show you there's plenty of photos online. And by plenty, I mean maybe a dozen photos online.
Yeah.
But what it shows is a warehouse that has been left open. And I think it's a warehouse. I'll have to read this little, you know what it is? It's a building that was once used by the stockyards that they used to move livestock in and out.
Oh, okay.
So it's this massive building. I mean, it's really, really long, kind of narrow. But it has all the problems that you would associate with a warehouse or a factory. It has columns, and it has slick concrete floors, like polished concrete floors. Now imagine drag racing on that surface.
Wow.
I mean, that's amazing. That's a surface that even, you know, skid loaders and forklifts have trouble getting grip on. And
right.
People.
Yeah.
So they're trying to drag race on this with relatively hard tires at the time. And we're not talking about just like, you know, the guys from the neighborhood drag racing. We're talking about like, you know, the heavy hitters of the day, like Arnie Beswick and, you know, some of the others that, you know, were the big shots of the time. They actually showed up to compete at these things. And it's crazy because, you know, at first they're indoors.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how loud that would have been?
Oh, yeah.
And the fumes, because, you know, it's all contained. So all these photos have kind of a smoky appearance to them, you know, while they're drag racing. And it's exactly what you would think, you know, the way it looks. It's a straight line shot. At the end, this is maybe the most bizarre part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You exit the building in order to enter the shutdown area. So that means that you're driving at the end at top speed. You're supposed to hit an area. It's in your lane. Of course, you want to be in your lane. You're going through a roll up garage door. To enter the shutdown area, which is outside of the building.
Yeah.
So you're at top speed as you're approaching that wall. And if you don't thread that needle, there's some, you know, serious consequences there. And there's some photos that show that not everybody made it through.
I was going to ask, did something happen?
There was a guardrail that they installed, of course, but, you know,
at that speed,
it really doesn't matter. Now, the course was pretty long. I think it was, or not as long as you might think, actually. I think it was a 440-foot course.
Huh.
Either 330 or 440 feet in length. I'm not exactly sure. But again, this early 1960s indoor drag racing in Chicago, look it up online. You'll see photos of it and it's pretty impressive. I mean, it's a neat idea. I love the photos. They're really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, especially look at this one where they're looking down. You almost can't see the end of the drag strip.
Yeah. You're not lying about that small.
That is a big, big building.
Yeah.
But, it's also a small building for what they were using it for, really.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding.
Interesting idea. It gave them a year-round racing season.
Ah, there's the rub.
Mm-hmm.
So we, unfortunately, Scott, did not get to all of our one more things, but mm-hmm. we kind of knew that going in.
Ah, this is a long podcast. I hope people didn't mind because, you know, there's so many more things that we want to talk about. Maybe we should do another one more thing at some point in the future. Not
definitely.
Not right away, but sometime soon.
Call it one more thing, too, the thinganing. Or two more things.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
Well, we'll work on the name. And while we go to do that, in the meantime, we hope that you have enjoyed this show of our short attention span theater for all things automotive. So go ahead and check out some of those other podcasts that we mentioned. You can find them all in one place at our handy dandy website, carstuffshow.com. You can find Scott and I on Twitter and on Facebook as well. Of course, if you would like to send one more thing to us, we're all about it. Our email address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Riley, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with Melissa Joan Hart.
LL Cool J gave me some great advice. He had all these gold chains, and I was like, wow, look at all these diamonds. And he said something to the effect of, don't waste your money on something like this. Buy a house. Like, he gave me, like, solid investment advice where I was like, save my money. Got it.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.